Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents He's with the Band by Julie Stone. Narrated by Tanya Eby. The lights were bright and flashing to the point I couldn't see past the first row. Not that I would have tried to look if it was possible. All I could think to see was the man dancing with me. The man who had pulled me up on stage, who held my hand to his lips as the driving beat sent me tumbling back to the girl I'd been the last time I'd seen him. Though, back then, I'd never captured his attention. It was a rush, more than I was prepared for. And it had my mind spinning with what-ifs and could-have-beens of the choices I'd made, and the life that might have been mine. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Chapter 1. It was hard for me to believe we were finally here. D-Day. Divorce. Jack, as usual, was way overdressed in his gray wool suit and French cuffed shirt. Beads of sweat had started to gather on his forehead, and he twisted at his cufflinks as we sat on a bench outside the courthouse, waiting on my lawyer. I was actually shocked he was willing to sit here, on the same bench, and wait with me. All three of those things went against everything Jack, my soon-to-be ex-husband, stood for. He didn't sit, or wait, or, lately, acknowledge my existence. I represented failure, another thing Jack did not do. If he was being honest, he was as shocked as I was we were here, but for different reasons. We had been married for just shy of 22 years. He'd swooped into my life full of pretty words and promises and the ability to kiss all my sense away. Unfortunately, the only thing real about the guy were those kissing skills. For all his promises of a beautiful life, what he delivered was a man incapable of taking care of himself. Turns out, while my 20-year-old self was marrying for stability, he was marrying to replace his mother. And her housekeeping, and her cooking, and her general way of always being put together and doing as she was told. I was none of those things, no matter how hard I'd tried to be.
"We're due in court in 10 minutes,
Jack said, checking his watch for the 100th time. His voice was terse, as it so often was with me, letting me know that whatever I was doing was inconveniencing him. This wasn't new. In fact, it had been part of our relationship from the start. I just chose to ignore it. He said he was close, I offered brightly. I refused to get drawn into some sort of tit-for-tat. His lawyer, who had been on time, was waiting outside the courtroom to make our excuses, in case mine really didn't show. Unlike Jack, who had connections and found the best, most competent lawyer, I'd found mine on the internet. Taking family portraits at a franchise studio didn't lend itself to rubbing elbows with the best and the brightest legal minds. Jack turned to me, and for a second, I thought he was going to put his hand on my knee.
"Maybe it's a sign, Campbell, him not showing up. Maybe it's the universe trying to give you one last chance to come to your senses."
He leaned forward just a hair, but enough that I pulled back slightly. The thought of it made my blood pressure spike, and I pursed my lips together so as not to blurt out that there wasn't a snowman's chance in hell. Also, since when did Jack believe in signs?
"I'm here. Sorry I'm late."
I had to squelch my cry of relief. I'd never been so glad to see anyone in my whole life. I stood to shake Steve's hand, and Jack shifted away from me. Steve, my lawyer, ignored my outstretched hand and pulled me into a completely inappropriate hug. "Are you drunk?" I asked as I pulled back. He smelled like the floor of a dive bar, stale beer and cigarettes.
"Maybe. Had quite a night. Slept in my suit, but new tie."
He held it out and waved it a bit like a flag. For sure he was drunk. Jack sighed dramatically in disgust.
"It didn't take you long to fall right back to your old life, a lawyer like that,"
he muttered just loud enough for me to hear. And there it was, my old life, the one I'd left in the dust when Jack proposed, thinking myself saved from the uncertainty, saved from my worst instincts, saved from people like Steve. But Steve, with his rumpled suit and apologetic smile, had been nothing but kind to me. I looked from him to Jack, and all I could think was that Steve had probably had more fun on his epic Tuesday night than Jack had allowed himself to have in 15 years. I shot Jack a look, and then looped my hand through Steve's arm. "Plenty of time," I said, and let him lead the way toward the courthouse and the start of my new life.
"Your Honor, as you can plainly see, I have been the primary breadwinner over the duration of our marriage. My wife's hobby job was but a small contribution. As she is the one who has brought these proceedings, I must ask that I be released from the obligation of supporting her further."
The sound of his voice, this particular tone, made me reflexively sit up taller, check to see that only the top two buttons of my blouse were undone, to smooth back my hair and make sure nothing was out of place. It was that last part that reminded me I didn't have to do as I was told anymore. My hair was down and untamed. My red waves hung unrestrained down my back, and I went from anxious to angry in a hot second. I leaned in and whispered in Steve's ear, "Hobby job? Does he mean the one he insisted I take instead of pursuing my career as a photojournalist?" I was seething. Steve patted my hand to calm me and switched his angle to reply.
"He also shouldn't be speaking at all. That's what his lawyer is for."
Yeah, there was little to no chance Jack wasn't going to speak. That would be ceding control to someone else. Even if he was paying that someone else, and that someone else was an expert in his field, no one knew better than Jack. Except, apparently, this judge.
"Mr. Spencer, there is no need for your personal pleas in my courtroom. Unless you're called upon, your voice in these proceedings belongs to your lawyer. Do you understand?" "But, Your Honor..."
Jack flashed what I knew to be his most charming smile.
"I just wanted to make sure you understood my perspective."
The judge, unlike most people, was not moved by Jack.
"A court of law is not the place for individual perspective. If the court wishes to hear from you, we will let you know."
It was almost worth the drama I'd gone through during arbitration to see that smile disappear and hear someone have authority over Jack. The funny part about all of this was he had no reason to be pleading his case anyway. We'd already negotiated down to the last fork in our drawer, which, by the way, he'd gotten. I'd already agreed to take no spousal support in exchange for keeping the house, though I didn't really want that either. Too many memories of a life controlled entirely by the man who sat at the opposing table. I'd come to realize in the months we'd been separated that I felt lonelier sitting next to him than I did when I was actually alone. Steve had argued against my concessions, telling me by law I was entitled to more, but I didn't want more. I just wanted out. When I'd married Jack, that control had seemed like stability and love to a girl who grew up with neither. Structure was a comfort. But over the years, from our friends to my job to the clothes I wore, Jack decided it all, and comfort changed to control.
"Your Honor, I appreciate your candor. I just want to say one last thing."
What that might have been, we'd never know, as the judge pounded his gavel to quiet the courtroom. He declared us divorced upon signature of the papers before him, and then he turned to exit the courtroom, but not before giving me a sympathetic look, as if to say he didn't blame me one bit. "That's it?" I asked Steve.
"That's it. You're officially divorced. Congrats?"
Chapter 2. In the end, I walked out of that courtroom feeling pretty much the same as when I'd walked in, with the added bonus of a sense of relief. I didn't even have time to dig into it, though. I had to hurry off to an appointment at my so-called hobby job at the Portrait Hut, which was now my only source of income. It was my least favorite kind of appointment, toddler holiday photos. For one, it was summer, so that kid would way rather be splashing in his kiddie pool than putting on an Argyle vest and corduroys, the standard outfit for his demographic. And two, the neurotic Pinterest mother would hang over my shoulder suggesting better ways for me to get the shot that would fulfill her vision. But at least it was a distraction. I unlocked the door of my studio, which was a pretty generous description of the space, It was little more than a remodeled office in a strip mall, and it wasn't even mine, and it was certainly not a hut. I was just the staff photographer. I rarely saw the owner, who cared way less about photography than about the bottom line. My backdrops and props were all limited to what the company sent each season, so Mama Pinterest could press all she wanted about having a unique look. That wasn't going to happen here. Most days it reminded me of that sad little photo studio tucked away in the back of Sears in the 80s. That magical place where families and matching outfits gathered too close together in front of a tan backdrop. A color that flattered no one, all for the sake of posterity. I had never sat for one, since marking any sort of occasion wasn't really my mom's style. But I do recall my best friend in 8th grade bemoaning the chambray shirt and khaki pant combo that her mother had chosen for theirs. It might have been the first time in my life I was thankful that my family wasn't picture perfect. After all, who rolls their pants up and goes barefoot in a Sears? As much as I loathed the work, it still put a camera in my hand for money. That's what I told myself on the days the soulless work really got to me. I flipped on the lights and pulled the Christmas backdrop to the front of the ones I had hanging on rings in the tiny space. Then I pulled out the winter/holiday props. Those were the only spots of flexibility. I'd broken the rules and not sent back last year's, so at least there was some variety. It was the most rebellious thing I'd done in years. If my younger self could have weighed in on what I counted as rebellion now, she would have rolled her eyes and probably taken a can of spray paint to it. Mama Bear was late. Par for the course, really. Once upon a time, I wouldn't have even thought this counted as photography. Would have looked down my nose at any photographer who sold out to do cookie-cutter portraits. Once upon a time, I actually considered myself an artist. I glanced at the gingerbread house backdrop and shook my head. This was not art. A sense of melancholy washed over me, not for my marriage, but for the person I'd let get swallowed up by Jack and his ideas of what a perfect life should look like. A real artist didn't want perfect, and yet I'd let myself be gaslit into a belief that perfect was the only measure of success. Why had I given up on myself so easily? Before I could answer, my appointment stormed in, screaming toddler in her arms. "I'm so sorry. Beckham is a bit upset about this whole thing," she said breathlessly. "But I just know you'll work your magic and get him smiling in no time." I had to force myself not to roll my eyes at this. My toddler magic was essentially bribing with food that wouldn't stain. And I was fresh out of organic non-gluten GMO-free, so this should go well. "Why don't you set him down there in front of the backdrop and see which of the props seem to engage him? And we'll go from there," I said as brightly as I possibly could. My portrait voice, I called it. She scowled slightly, waving her hands at the setup. "I'm not sure this goes with my vision." And there it was, the V word. If I had a dollar for every time I heard the word vision in my line of work, I wouldn't have to work. Or so the saying goes. I turned and walked toward where my camera was already on its tripod. As we discussed, the company dictates what backdrops are used this time of year. They like uniformity, branding. Your holiday card is our best advertising. Portrait voice again. She sighed heavily, but did as she was told. Young Beckham quieted down as he looked wide-eyed at his new surroundings, and then let out a squeal as he reached for the oversized stuffed candy canes that littered the floor. Snap, snap, snap. I looked through the viewfinder. Pure delight on that baby's face, even stuffed into his ridiculous old man-looking outfit. Yeah, I was that good. After 20-odd years at this, I should be. The mom even offered a coo of appreciation. 30 minutes later, he had made his way through the props, eaten his body weight in goldfish, and just as his mother was insisting I try a more sophisticated shot of him sitting on a miniature bench, seriously, did she think he was actually 75? He filled his diaper. "Well, I think we have some really great shots, and I believe Beckham has moved on to other things." She leaned over my shoulder to look through the viewfinder. "I just really wanted some portraits of him on the bench." And so we sat Beckham on the bench. which he obviously did not like. A full diaper does not make for comfortable seating. He stood, his toothy smile replaced by one of discomfort. Years of doing this told me that we weren't going to get anything close to a usable photo. But the customer was always right, or so I told myself. I snapped a few more as the baby's face went from discomfort to pure frown. The mom started clapping and saying his name, trying to, what, distract him? Make him smile? Scare the shit out of him? Too late. That had already happened. Pun intended. I glanced at the spectacle she was making, and that's why I missed young Beckham sticking his hands down the back of his diaper and coming out full. He shrieked. His mom shrieked. I looked over just in time to see him start wiping his fingers on my bench. And then when that didn't clean them off, down the front of his Argyle vest. Oh my God, his mother said, scrambling for the wipes she'd used to disinfect every inch of that bench before she'd let Beckham get anywhere near it. That outfit was not coming back from this. Our photo shoot was over. She scooped him up, holding him away from her, and raced to the changing table I had long ago set up in the far corner of the room. It must have been bad, because she let out another, oh my God! I busied myself spraying down the bench, thanking the good Lord myself that Beckham hadn't cleaned his hands on the gingerbread backdrop. Disinfecting that would have cleared my books for at least a week's worth of appointments. Though, when I thought about it, that didn't seem all that bad. I'll send you the proofs once I get them edited. There will be a link with your discount code in the email, so you should be all set. I had to yell at this point because young Beckham was not enjoying his cleanup. And what's the policy if there isn't one that's usable? She asked, the baby, naked but for his fresh diaper, on her hip as she walked toward the front door. It was a standard question that I got often, but it still made me so sad. Her baby was adorable. I'd love to sit his naked self in front of that backdrop and hand him a plate of cookies, showing off his delightful chubby thighs. But that wasn't what Pinterest was pushing this year. I sighed. We'll have to book another session. She started to argue the price, but Beckham took it up a notch, now swatting at her with his tiny fists, his cries forming the word home over and over. So she just nodded and walked out. The dirty diaper was sitting in a ball on the changing table. Apparently her vision didn't include cleaning up after herself. Chapter 3. Just as I was slipping off the rubber gloves, the diaper taken care of, my phone rang. Campbell, I got wine. I got champagne. What else do we need for tonight? Marissa, my dearest friend, sing-songed. I glanced at my calendar. Wednesday. On Wednesdays, Jack and I had pork chops and watched Antiques Roadshow on PBS. Jack loved that show for the people who thought they had forgotten treasure and found it was worth next to nothing. I can't. It's a weeknight. Jack and I... What the actual hell are you talking about? There is no Jack in you anymore. Unless he pulled a fast one and got the date moved. She sounded panicked. Oh my God. She was right. I was no longer beholden to Jack and his routines and schedules. I could do anything I wanted on a Wednesday now. Holy shit, I'm just so used to the schedule, his schedule. Holy shit. You scared the crap out of me. Are we going out? Staying in? How are we celebrating the first night of the rest of your life? What if we didn't make a plan? I ventured, feeling a new lightness in my chest. Come over and let's just see where the night takes us. Marissa literally gasped through the phone. Campbell Spencer without a plan? Do I even know you anymore? Cavett, I corrected. It's Campbell Cavett again. Gah, you took your name back? I didn't know that was happening. Campbell Cavett sounds like a wild child. Wild child? I like the sound of that. The memory of that. 7 o'clock, my place, I said. See you then. Marissa replied, like she was taking a direct order, and then hung up decisively. This day was officially over, so I locked up and headed for my car, a gray four-door sedan with beige interior. High safety ratings, but zero sex appeal. This car was as boring as the NPR station that Jack had programmed first on the radio. I unlocked the door and climbed inside, remembering the last car I'd picked out for myself, a used VW Bug, sky blue. I'd paid cash, babysitting money, my life savings at the time. It had been old and unreliable. The passenger window sometimes just fell straight down for no reason, and it didn't always start. But it was effortlessly, undeniably cool. And it started when I'd needed it to, when I'd hit the road and left my dysfunctional fighting parents in their dirty, falling-down house. I'd loved that car, and what it had done for me. It had gotten me on the open road. I wondered how many miles I'd traveled in it, my eyes trained on the tour bus taillights in front of me, the corners of my mouth lifted at the memory. Inside the sedan, I flipped down the visor and looked at myself hard in the tiny mirror, trying to recognize any part of myself. The past 20-odd years were literally one boring blur. And even though I felt unrecognizable from the inside, the outside was vaguely familiar. Same red hair, same ice-blue eyes, a few extra lines around my eyes and mouth. 42. How was that possible? I sighed. Maybe, just maybe, Campbell Cavett could bring back the spark Campbell Spencer had let be snuffed out. I turned the ignition and reached for the radio. Once, a long time ago, music was the thing that mattered most to me. A place to put everything I felt. Happiness, sadness, confusion, anger. There was a song for all of it. It was my therapy. It directed my emotions like nothing before or since, and had always been there, giving me just what I needed, when I needed it. I punched the scan button and left it up to the universe to decide just what song would play me home. And when it landed on a driving beat and a scorching guitar, the tension of the day melted away. Campbell Cavett sounds like a wild child. Oh, Marissa, you have no idea. There was cake. Chocolate with some sort of malted buttercream icing. Straight out of Marriage, it said in a gothic-looking yellow font. A celebration should always have cake, Marissa had declared and handed it to me when she walked in. I know we're seeing how the night plays out, but cake is never the wrong call. Marissa was the best, the most thoughtful human being on the planet. She was single, too, though not by choice. Her husband had passed away almost 13 years ago, leaving her with a daughter to raise. That and the high bar he'd set in the romance department had kept her single and down to earth. I was happy to see her, happier still to see the cake, and to not be alone with my thoughts anymore. She was right. This was worthy of a celebration. I needed to focus my energy there, and not on the fact that it took me so many years to figure out I missed myself. There was wine, too. Pinot Grigio. It was so ridiculously stereotypical middle-aged woman. But let's be honest, it didn't stop this 42-year-old woman from throwing it down. To new beginnings, Marissa exclaimed. White wine and cliche toasts. This was officially the opposite of wild. I lifted my glass to receive her well wishes. Marissa was my best friend, and always well-intentioned, so her heart was in the right place. I took a healthy swallow of my wine and closed my eyes tight. Marissa laid her hand on my arm. Are you okay? Would you rather this was more of a wake than a celebration? Hardly, I replied. I'm ecstatic, over the moon. All the usual things one says when they are recently divorced from a man who loved the idea of who he turned them into, and not the person they ever actually were. Marissa raised her eyebrows. Man, that's deep. I just can't stop wondering where I'd be if I hadn't fallen for Jack's particular brand of bullshit, I said. I think it's normal for you to feel like that. I let so much of my life fly by without paying attention. So many New Year's resolutions that this was the year I took control, and then did nothing to change a bit of it. This isn't where I wanted to be or what I wanted to be doing. No little girl is out there dreaming of this job, these clothes, this house. I mean, look at this place. It's so beige. I was practically yelling while I waved my arms around to include my entire living space in my outrage. Actually, the room was a very nice shade of beige. Rice cracker, it was called. But beige was a metaphor for what I was trying to get across. This life had no excitement, no color. I was an artist, a photographer. I saw things in color and lines and shapes and shadows. But there was none of that here. And I had to wonder if there was not much left in me, either.
Marissa shrugged. I think you were just trying to be in love.
A person shouldn't have to try to be in love. Not with a person or with their life. That's something that should just be.
I took a drink of my wine. Don't beat yourself up. Jack is an ass. But he's attractive in an uptight way, and he can be very charming. So you were fooled. But you're not anymore. You signed at the X, and now you can move on to better things.
She was right. What was the point in looking back? Unless it was way back.
I stood, ignoring the way both my knees cracked when they extended, and crossed the family room to my newly acquired record player. Jack, of course, had taken his state-of-the-art sound system, but I'd been happy to replace it. Vinyl was so much better. How had I forgotten? I grabbed the album on top of the stack and put it on. The song started, and the crackle of the needle only made it a more authentic trip down memory lane. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh my God, is this Golden Tiger? Marissa crossed the room, grabbing hold of my shoulders and spinning me around. Her ability to recognize the song from just the count-in cemented her place in my heart. I loved them. She threw her arms up in the air, swaying with the beat.
I was never very good at hello, but baby, you make me want to try.
The voice that launched pretty much every fantasy of my youth, Davis Scott. I let myself succumb to the song, singing along, remembering that summer. My Golden Tiger summer. My heart squeezed. I crossed the room to where Jack had left his liquor, which was only for show and guests, anyway, pulled out a bottle of whiskey, and poured 2 shots. I handed one to Marissa, who took it skeptically. White wine and margarita Mondays were as crazy as she got. Cheers to the good years, I said, and threw back the whiskey. It burned, like whiskey always does, but this time it felt good. Like a cleansing. I poured another. I thought I'd feel different when the divorce was final, like I had a new life, but the thing is, it's all still the same. Same ridiculous beige house, same uninspiring job I hate. Just no Jack. Marissa did her shot, throwing her head of jet black curls back in dramatic fashion. No offense, but your job is pretty terrible. All those annoying parents and screaming kids. I nodded. My ears felt warm. Don't forget about the sulky teenagers. They might be worse. Yours excluded, of course. Of course, Sasha is never sulky. She rolled her eyes. You know, once upon a time, I wanted to be an actual photographer. I had talent, too. Or so I was told.
You should quit your job, Marissa said.
A slight whiskey slur to her words. But to my fuzzy brain, it sounded like a good idea. I nodded in agreement. I totally should. The song switched to a pounding beat, the bass coming in low and hard, and then the guitar. I turned the volume up so loud, the pictures on the walls shook. By the time the vocals started, Marissa and I were shout-singing along and dancing. Jesus, how long had it been since I danced? We made it the whole song, collapsing on the couch as it transitioned into a ballad. My heart was pounding. I cannot believe I still know all the words, she said breathlessly. I don't think I could ever forget them. I poured us another shot, the booze spilling out onto the cream carpet I despised. If I sold this crappy house, I could quit my job and live off the money until I figured out what's next, I exclaimed. Clean slate. Marissa nodded her encouragement. Now you're talking. Take control of your own destiny. We upended our shots, slamming the glasses down on the Pottery Barn coffee table in, you guessed it, beige, as though it were a water-stained bar top. I let my head fall back on the couch, embracing the way the whiskey was somehow able to make all the harsh edges of my life smooth. I hummed along to the song, grasping at the fine threads of that perfect summer. I turned the album over in my hands, so familiar but so out of context in these uniform walls. Destiny. That was a word I hadn't thought about in a long, long time.
I think I read somewhere that they're launching a reunion tour to celebrate the 20th anniversary of their first tour.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?